still remembers fire. Grass remembers rain. Every scar tells a story carved out of pain. If you go digging, son, best mind what you find. The truth.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire. Y'all, presumably, still y'all. All are welcome here in the Church of Internal Combustion. We just ask that you show up with an open heart. Goodness, it is Sunday morning, about 8 o'clock in the a.m. It's a balmy 61 degrees. It's been cool here the last couple days. And then last night, I guess we got some moisture or some kind of front come through and fogged everything up. It's making my voice sound a little cloggy this morning. There's so much moisture in there. You can almost see it sitting out there. So it's a little warmer today, but it's supposed to be back down like 38 tomorrow. So we'll see. 38 is too cold for me. Just so you know, I thought part of the deal was like I live in the South and I get the piss cooked out of me all summer long and well up into the fall. But the trade-off was that was I don't have to have a parka or a heavy jacket. But it's bullcrap. Last week down here has been cold as piss. And I don't want to hear from you northerners like, oh, 45 degrees ain't nothing. I go out there in my t-shirt and shovel the driveway with my nose. You know, bullshit. First off. Second, I've been up there. I've lived up there in that kind of cold. I lived in Wisconsin. Yeah, 45 degrees in Wisconsin. I was running around in t-shirts. 45 degrees in Wisconsin ain't 45 degrees on the Gulf Coast with the humidity. Ain't the same thing. Ain't the same thing by any stretch. And I'll call any man a liar that says it is. Ain't the same thing. You come down here and walk around 40 degrees and tell me all that bullshit. But I don't believe it. I don't believe it. You can tell it to me all you want. Whew. My God. I didn't feel like grinding coffee this morning, so my sister had some coffee. She left here, and I decided to try some of it. And it's some sort of Indonesia Sumatrian, I don't know. Whoa. Tastes like it's made out of tree root. Anyways. All right. That's an interesting flavor profile right there. It's notes of shit. Oh, am I in a mood this morning? I don't even mean to be. I actually feel great. Woke up early and went to bed kind of late, but just we were watching a TV show, me and Mom, and having some drinks, hanging out on the porch, that sort of thing, howling at the moon a little bit. We got all our Christmas decorations out and got the house all decorated for Christmas. Got the tree up and, of course, little Ophelia, the cat, of course, is taking a great deal of interest in the tree, immediately climbing up and in and out of it. So I think this will be another year we keep the broken ornaments in the box. I mean, the breakable ornaments in the box. I see all these cat people that are, Rachel posts a picture of it, all the cat people. Nobody can just appreciate anything anymore. Everybody's got to, I got to tell you how to do that. Everybody's got to, you know what I mean? You can't post a picture of yourself fishing. Everybody, oh, I wouldn't use that bullshit test line. Oh, I wouldn't use that rod. Oh, I wouldn't be running that kind of bait. Oh, here's what you're doing wrong. Like, everybody just has to be an actually Adam nowadays. Like, you never see, very rarely do you ever see somebody comment and just be like, oh, that's cool. Thanks for sharing. You know what I mean? Or something like that. It's always just some jackass that nobody else listens to, ever. Got to come in there and offer their 2 cents. And sure enough, somebody was like, oh, y'all don't even know what it's like to have a cat. No, but we got kids. We got kids. And one of them's autistic as all hell. And we've had to do all kind of crazy shit with the Christmas tree over the course of the kids' development to keep the Christmas tree intact. Well, one year we had no ornaments till like 4 feet up. Oh, sorry for all the snorting, guys. I'm a little clogged up this morning. Anyway, so we got all the Christmas stuff out. I feel pretty good about that. And I was real proud of myself the way I put it in the garage a certain way last year and had it organized such a way that this year, when it come time to... Because like on that side of the garage over there, so I got my y'all can't see it from here, but straight across that way behind the camera. On that side in the second bay of the garage is where I have my green screen set up. And that's where I film all the truck straw, any of the videos I do, the green screen, truck straw, all that bullshit, right? I film over there. And I leave that set up all the time. And I use these same lights that I use for this set, but I just move them back and forth across the garage. And it's not really that big a deal. I've got cords set up where I can just drag them over there and flip them on. But then I've also got a bunch of garage sale and a bunch of stuff over there stored that, like a lot of that stuff that's going to my cousin Ricky when he comes down with mom's car. It's a bunch of that stuff I promised him. Table full of tools and all kind of shit I'm getting rid of, right? But last year, I was smart. Last year, we've been putting this crap in the attic and just getting that Christmas tree in and out of the attic. I don't trust that attic ladder. I'm a smaller boy than I was when I first started working on this house, but I don't trust that attic ladder. And I don't like ladders in general. And I don't like that attic. And also, we live in the seventh circle of hell, and shit you put in the attic just gets cooked to smithereens. So last year I organized it such a way that I could get in here quickly. When mama said, I need Christmas decorations, boom, boogity, boom. I come off in here, got them, Halloween decorations, got them Halloween decorations out. Halloween box in the house. When she's tired of the Halloween box, she's ready for that Christmas box. Bam, Halloween back out here. And I was able to get all the Christmas stuff and the tree out in like 10 minutes yesterday. Like she was like, we were on the way home from a family event. And she's like, I really want to do Christmas decorations. It's getting late. You feel like doing it? I was like, I got you, boo. I got you. And literally just ran out here. And in 15 minutes, I had it all ready to go in the house and had the Halloween stuff put up. And so I was really proud. I'm not an organized guy normally. So I was proud. I was like, look at what you did, buddy. So it worked out pretty good. We all loaded up, went down to Kima yesterday. See my little niece, my little Vivian, my brother Joey's kid. I can't remember how old she is. I think maybe 5, maybe 6. This kid is I call her my little sweet pea, but she is just a mouncy ball of energy. She's just the tiniest little old thing, and she never stops moving, and she never stops talking, and I just adore her. I absolutely adore her. She's tremendous. My brother is one of those, I'm never going to have kids, guys. He had said that for years, years, years. Never going to have a kid. No interest having a kid. And brother, y'all met him. Kind of quiet-spoken. A little reserved. not what you would call a hyper person or prone to flights of fancy. Ended up with a child that is this bouncing ball of energy who only lives in flights of fancy. And I just love it. I just love it. She's a riot. We went down there. So she's in dance. And we went down to the San Jacinto College to watch the dance recital. Which, you know, I'm not much of a dance enthusiast, I guess you would call it. I couldn't tell you the difference between a pirouette and a Panera Bread most of the time. Sorry, that was the next P word I could think of. But of course, they had the older dancers, the older girls come out and do their dance. They were going to dance in a parade later that day. It was all holiday themed, all Christmas themed. And I was worried, we were in this pretty good sized auditorium. I was worried I wouldn't be able to tell which one was my niece, you know, because I couldn't really see the little girls' faces. And they did all ages. And they had this one age group that I suspect maybe these little girls were 2 or 3 years old. And they were in these little shimmery ballerina costumes with big dresses on, big skirt, tutu, whatever the shit that thing's called. And they were dancing to a very slowed down tempo version of Do You Want to Build a Snowman? And me and my wife were talking. We suspect they slow the tempo down because they're very, very young kids. And you could tell they were all looking at a teacher off in the wings who was telling them when to do their little toot-toot-toot thing and all that good stuff. And they're all that. I learned some shit yesterday. Those of y'all listening to this, y'all missed out on my badass dance moves just now. That's what you get for listening to it. Damn. Sorry. Ooh, I'm clogged up. That's weird. The weather changed. Anyways, they were doing, it was five little girls. And they were doing the thing. And they were okay as far as time, and, you know, most of them were relatively within a few seconds of each other. And, but there was this fourth little girl in the lineup, a little blonde-headed girl. And she was about a minute behind everybody else, and then sometimes a minute ahead of everybody else. And she was adorable, and she was looking for cues, and I think she was probably the youngest one. But I was watching this, I was listening to that music, and I was thinking about my kid, especially my oldest was young and was so hooked on that movie, Frozen. And I was watching those little girls dance, and that fourth one was just so out of sync. She was just doing her best. She was just giving it her all. She was going to show her stuff, and she just kept on keeping on. And even at the end, one of the other little girls had to help her figure out which way to go off stage. And it's delightful. But also I realized I'd like gone through my entire life like that fourth little girl. Just out of step, out of time. Don't know to stop. Just keep going. And it tickled me. It was kind of a moment of beauty. It tickled me endlessly. I giggled through the next two dance sets thinking about it. Like, this is exactly how you've gone through your life, sir. Just a little out of time. A little out of step. Not quite keeping up with the crowd. That's okay. Most important thing is that you do not quit. But I was worried because I couldn't see them little girls' faces that I might not know when my little niece, my little Vivian, came on stage. And, you know, she's there who I'm there to see. And my brother whispered in my ear, told me the two songs she was going to dance to. And so I was like, okay, well, at least I know I hear those songs. I'll be looking for her on stage, which was ridiculous. Because when it came time for her little group to dance and they bring the lights down so they can get out there on stage and get into their, whatever you call that, their little setup, you know, on stage, I saw this little shadow run and do five extra bounces to get in their spot. And I immediately was like, oh, that's my niece. There she is. There's that sweet pea. Knew immediately. I didn't need to see her face. And she was a ham. I mean, that little girl is the enthusiasticest little dancer you ever seen in your life. She's always dancing and grooving and jiving, you know. She's always moving and grooving. And she would spin so hard, she would throw herself off kilter and have to recover. But she would recover in epic fashion by doing this little river walk type dance to get back into line. And it was just fantastic. Watching her performance, and she had two little songs that she was a part of. And both of them were just delight. They did the first one twice. They did three, actually, because they did the first one twice. They did the first one once. And then they come out after another set of a different girl's dancing, and they did it again, and we were all trying to figure out what happened. And one of the little girls had not been there for the first dance, and they wanted to make sure she got to dance on stage, so they just redid it. And that's the joy of doing live performances. And certainly the joy, probably, of live performances involving children is that you can always just have a little empathy in your heart and go, hey, let's do it again. Them other old girls, you think they cared about having to dance again? Heck no, they were excited. Of course, after Joey had brought her a big thing of roses, and I was in theater in high school. I have a love for all that sort of thing, you know, live performance, that kind of stuff. And she was just carrying her little roses and just dancing all over the place. And she was still dancing after the show. She's still just moving and grooving. There's a big hill out there. She's got to run up on top of the hill. And I remember her grandmother said, have her go up on top of that hill. Get her to go up on top of that hill so I can take a picture. And I laughed like, get her? I knew the minute I saw that hill, that kid was going to be on top of that hill. And sure enough, seconds later, she's on top of it posing. Get her to go on that hill and take a picture. little lunatic. Oh. Of course, we went, had some lunch with my brother and his wife Sarah and her mom and kids, and this is a good time. I screwed up, though. I have not been eating. I have not been eating fried food. I've not really been eating much in the way of fast food, except when I travel. And I usually try to go light on that because my stomach don't like it anymore. After going a period of time without eating a bunch of it, my stomach doesn't much care for it. And I made the mistake of eating tater tots and chicken strips. And oh my God, my system revolted on me yesterday. I thought I was going to spend the rest of the night in the bathroom. It was not good. Will not be doing that again. I looked at my wife. I was like, man, next time I'm thinking about eating fried food, just remind me of this day. Remind me how terribly this went. There's a little bit about my week for you. Been a good week. We had a good Thanksgiving. My oven part came in. I fixed my oven without cussing. It's nice to have a good fix. I've talked about that before, but sometimes it's just nice when something works, you know. Like I said, I ain't mad at that oven. It's a 20-year-old oven. And 20 years, after 20 years, I had to buy a $100 part to fix it off eBay. and literally fixed it within about 25, 30 minutes. Change out that little oven motorized latch. Plugged it in, let it go through its diagnostic. Everything works great. So if I get another 10 years out of that oven, then by God, I just don't want to have to buy any appliances before we move from here. You know, I don't want to have to take any appliances with me. I won't. When I leave here, most likely probably rent this place out and it'll have some appliances in it that work, that sort of thing, and not have to tote a bunch of shit. Because I have a feeling we move from here, it's going to be a long distance move. And we both, me and my wife both, would like to get out of Texas. For a number, a variety of reasons. But I'm not, I've been real disimpressed with Texas leadership for a long time. Even before the current fella running things, but it's not a lot of things going in the direction that make me feel like Texas will continue to be a good place for my family. So fine, sorry, and we won't ready for a different climate. I'm you know, that's where people are like, oh, you don't like the cold. How are you going to handle being somewhere like Colorado? Bro, I've been in Colorado in the cold. It ain't like here. It's that's why when we make those comparisons, they're ridiculous, you know? In the same way, I've worked in 112 degrees in Arizona. It sucked. Don't get me wrong. Sun was cooking you. But it ain't like 108 here with humidity. Yeah, 108 here with the humidity of the Gulf Coast changes all the weather. That's the dad thing. It ain't the heat, it's the humidity. It ain't the cold, it's the humidity. Yeah, I've literally worked above the Mississippi River shooting a 2-inch pipeline. It was cold. It was like negative 20 with wind chill. And it may not have been that cold. I'm probably exaggerating. But it was ridiculously cold, hovering down in the next to nothings. And still would take that over some of the weather we've had down here with that extra moisture in there. That extra moisture in there makes a difference. That extra moisture air means that cold cuts you like a knife. The extra moisture air means that you're not just getting oven baked, you're getting sous vide. It's just different. And whew, I think I'll be all right. I'm just going to wear a sweater always once I get somewhere else. Also, thanks mostly to you guys, we went and made our first donation Friday for the DrivenDreams.org thing. We've been collecting the Hot Wheels and the die-cast cars. So we ended up with like 1,885 cars, and I split that up three ways because I wanted to spread it out. And three ways, that still breaks down to like 624 or something. I'm not good at math. I did it on a calculator one day. Like 624 cars. And then one of y'all sent a bunch of these track creator sets, and I threw a couple of those in each one of these three piles. And it's good I split them up that way, because turns out about 624 cars is what the Mazda trunk holds. I probably could have got more in there, but it'd been a tight fit. And I took those over to the fellow I'm going to talk to y'all about today. I've told you a few stories about him here and there over the years, and year and a half or so I've been doing this. But my good buddy, Randy Lee. And Randy Lee has a tattoo business, a tattoo shop here in Houston. And he's had it for, man, I think over at least over a decade for sure. He did. So I have a tattoo on my inner forearm, and I think he did that at his first shop location. Yeah, definitely over 10 years. It was when me and Rachel got married, so like 2008. He already had that shop running. Yeah, it's a nice shop. He's a critically acclaimed artist. Has his own style, very unique. I love his artwork. And over the course of that time, all those years, he's always run a Toys for Tots drop-off, Toys for Tots courses, affiliated with the United States Marine Corps. And he's, all these years, he's run a Toys for Tots drop-off and tries to gather up a big donation from his customers and people in his community every year. And so I wanted to take one of those loads to Randy. He's been a good steward of his community, and I see the work he puts in, and I wanted to go take one of those donations over there for the Driven Dreams and leave with him for the Toys for Tots. And then I'm going to take one of the other splits. There's a fella here, and we'll talk more about him next week or maybe a little closer to Christmas, that we call Poncho Claus, Richard Reyes. Richard Reyes has been a community outreach leader in Houston, Texas, as long as I've been in Houston, Texas. Like, just good 30 years or more. He has made it his absolute mission to make sure underprivileged kids get Christmas every year. And they have a lowrider convertible, and he wears a red zoot suit and a red hat. He's Poncho Claus, and we see him on the news all the time. We're kids doing stuff, and Richard Reyes is a huge ambassador to the comedy scene in Houston, Texas. He supports a lot of live performance, and he promotes shows, and not for money, just for the good of the community. And the man has worked tirelessly for years through his own health problems. I mean, he's almost died a couple times, and you know, he doesn't live a life of luxury. He lives a life of a servant for the people. And so I'm real proud to go take him, finally be able to kind of do something with him and go take him a big donation for the Driven Dreams. And him and Toys for Tots give out stuff locally in the community. And then there's another charity here in town that's also done a lot of good work for years, 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 called the Houston Children's Charity. And they are partially, they get some of their funding from the children's hospitals. There's a big mattress company that provides beds for kids, Texas Mattress Makers, right here in Houston. They're a big mattress building company, and they give out beds for children. They do Christmas stuff for them every year, so we're going to take them the other part of that donation. I'm feeling pretty excited about that. And you know, 98% of those donations came from y'all. Y'all put a lot of joy out in the world this year. And I'm just so happy to kind of be the messenger and the delivery man for it. It just tickles me to death. Randy's shop is beautiful. First of all, Randy's art is nothing short of stunning to me. There's a period of time where you watch a young artist draw and draw and draw, and they mimic the styles of other artists, much in the way as a writer, as I've learned to write, I've mimicked the styles of other writers, how I learned how to mimic Faulkner. And I can mimic Cormac McCarthy pretty good, too. I just don't like Cormac McCarthy. Not I don't like him, but the very first Cormac McCarthy book I ever read was called The Road. And if you're familiar with the book, it is bleak. It is bleak. And I'm not into bleak. And so I don't enjoy his writing as much. And I haven't read a lot else by him. That book kind of turned me off on him. And my buddy Adam's editor is always telling me, man, you got to give Cormac another try. You know, you got to read this, you got to read that. And I probably will at some point, but I just haven't spent a lot. But I'm very good at mimicking him, his sentence structure, and kind of old school biblical language and resoluteness is something that's easy for me to mimic if I would like to. It's not something I enjoy. I don't like it as much, but you see that with creatives. You see, everybody's inspired by something. And a lot of my early stand-up comedy, you can really see Ralphie Mae's fingerprints all over it and Sam Kinison's fingerprints on it and a little bit of Richard Pryor on it. And, you know, even my comedy, even my stand-up now, you can still see evidence of Ralphie's influence on me. Like, there's no doubt about it. I so many times I've had old friends of his come up and go, man, that one bit you do kind of reminds me of Ralph, you know, that kind of thing. And like, yeah, man, well, spent a lot of time learning from the dude. But there comes a time where you find your own voice, either as an artist or a woodworker, whatever it is, where you find your own voice and you stop relying on mimicry, and your art takes a form of its own with its own signature and its own style. And I've come into that in the last 4 or 5 years, that my art is starting to take its own signature and style. And people can kind of recognize when it's me doing something, not just from the voice, but from the style in which I do things. I really stumbled on it in writing while I was working on The Wrecking Yard. And Randy hit his own style 20 years ago, but what has happened as a result of that is he has just further developed it. And his artwork just, it stuns me. He did my tattoo on my hand, and it was based on an idea I had in my head and one little image I had drawn. And then he took it and just gave it kind of this life, this bigger than life quality. And I just couldn't be happier with the work he did for me. And he's going to start another tattoo for me that I've talked to y'all a little bit about, but we're going to do a full sleeve on my left arm. And the sleeve is going to be dedicated to The Wrecking Yard. And it's going to have all the cars from the first season peppered into it like a junkyard, with kudzu and a little Wrecking Yard sign. And, of course, my more prominent cars I want to be displayed a little more clearly. And I have this Phoenix tattoo up here on my left shoulder that is something I drew and I had another tattoo artist do when I was younger. And because I was too busy doing cocaine, I never went and got the tattoo finished. And then that young artist was in a car wreck in Hawaii, killed him. So that tattoo's kind of unfinished. I've been walking around for 20-something years with this unfinished tattoo on my left shoulder. So Randy took pictures of that and traced it all out and all that good stuff so that he can come up with a way to beautify it. Because I think the Phoenix, the whole time we were writing The Wrecking Yard and the whole time I was writing it and working on it and going back and forth, there was always this symbolism of the Phoenix that is associated, for me, in my mind, with The Wrecking Yard. That's why I got the original tattoos. This thing, we're always rising from the ashes. You're taking things that are broken and putting them back together. They don't get no more Phoenix than that. And so I want to keep that imagery, but he's going to tie it in and just really put his zzz on it and make it something special. So it's good to sit. Very rarely I get an unencumbered afternoon where I don't have other stuff I'm supposed to be doing. And I had myself a good 3 or 4 hours to just go over there and visit with Randy, and he didn't have much clientele, and it was just a good afternoon to catch up with this fellow that I've known since we were 13 years old. His shop is beautiful. It's a curation. It's like an art exhibit when you walk into his shop. Just art he's collected over the years, art other people have done for him, art he paints wooden signs, and he does these wood cutouts, and there's a bunch of that in there, and it's just it's really beautiful. It's a beautiful place to go into. If you're ever in the Houston area, thinking about getting some artwork done, you should look up Bayou City Tattoos. And Randy Lee Woods is a tremendous artist. There was a moment when I was talking to him, just catching up on the story. So me and Randy were estranged for many years, and we don't get to see each other very often anymore. Usually when I go get a tattoo, you know, because he works all the time and I work all the time. That's what you do when you're growing up. And though we live in the same city, we live on different ends of it. You know, he kind of lives out there close to A-Leaf. Well, he lives in Katy. And I'm on the north side of town. And the old joke is Houston's an hour away from Houston. Well, Katy's like 2 hours away. It's not that bad, but it is a miserable trip to get out there and back. Whew, I had coffee. Ha! Lord, I don't know what my sister's drinking. Indonesian Sumatra or whatever the hell. So we're catching up. We hadn't really got to hang out much since the pandemic. Just one time when I went and had him do my tattoo on my hand. And he wants to tune it up. He wants to dress up some of the color and tune it up. Hand tattoos are difficult because you're the skin on your hand, I forgot the word. Skin on your hand acts differently than skin on different parts of your body, and so sometimes it makes ink take the hard to take hold. And even though he put plenty of black on the bird's beak on my knuckle, it didn't it scarred a little bit, and I lost some of the black there. And so he's going to just tune up some of the black and some of the white highlights and stuff like that. There was a moment when I was talking to him, we were just catching up on the stories we don't know about each other and the people we do have in common. And in the course of the conversation, talking about our careers and stuff, he told me he was looking forward to moving out to a piece of land out in the country in the next 5 years. And it's weird to hear guys my age talk about not shutting it down, but moving on to the next chapter. He's like, you know, I'll probably keep the shop, hire somebody to run it, but I'm ready to go out there so I can just hunt and fish, have a piece of land, shoot my guns, do that sort of thing. I must have looked at him funny. Like, hey, gum, you know? Because then he said, dude, we're nearly 50 years old. And when he said we're nearly 50 years old, I started giggling uncontrollably. The absurdity of it just tickled the shit out of me. Like, I couldn't wrap my head. It's weird. Like, it's one, my wife gives me, I'm 5 years older than my wife, and my wife gives me grief all the time about my age, you know, but it's just joking, and it doesn't really, you know, I always joke like, no, I'm still in my mid-40s, you know, that kind of thing. But somebody your own age going, dude, we're nearly 50. It struck me in a way, I couldn't stop laughing about it. And I just looked at him, I go, somebody lost money. And he started giggling too. He's like, your dad, my dad. I was like, you ain't kidding, you know. We have damn near made it to 50. I mean, that feels like something in itself, you know. But it was weird to think about that. Like, look at your buddy that you were teenagers with and go, we're nearly 50. Shit struck me. My father-in-law used to tell me all the time, he was in his late 50s, early 60s, and the guys at work would refer to him as the old dude, and it would get under his skin a little bit, and he would tell me all the time, he'd say, you know, I don't know when I became the old guy. I don't know when that happened. I still feel the same inside. And I was too young to grasp what he was saying when he was telling me that, but I get it now. Like I remember when it happened to me, especially like in the comedy scenes, a lot of young dudes, you know, and all of a sudden you're kind of one of the granddaddies all of a sudden. And it is that moment yesterday or Friday just struck me so deeply. I couldn't stop laughing. The absurdity of me being nearly 50 years old was just too much for my brain to comprehend in that moment. It's something different when your peer, somebody your own age says it, and you have to just stand there in the light of it and bear witness to the truth that they're dropping on you. I was probably 13 when I met Randy. We lived in Mission Bend in Houston. I was always already friends with Melissa and had my little crush on her. And I met Randy at school. We both went to Albright Middle School. And I was a bit of an outcast, and Randy also a bit of an outcast. Randy was a big kid. Heavy. I don't want to call him fat. Because I was kind of a chubby fat kid, but he was just big. He was big all over. He was big. He was taller than us, broader than us. He's a big kid. Overweight, sure, but big. He was a bruiser. Kind of had red hair and was goofy as shit. Was a silly dude. We would have so much fun together hanging out. He would always make me laugh. I just always really enjoyed him when we were that age. And we would spend our days just running around going hang out in the bayou and looking for stuff in the bayou and catching giant bullfrogs down in the bayou. I'd spend the night at his house. He'd spend the night at our house. We had another little friend named Johnny Scoggins that Randy and Johnny had been friends for a while. My parents were strict. Randy's parents were pretty authoritarian back then too, but a little more lax. And Johnny Scoggins' dad was an authoritarian nightmare. He was kind of abusive, not kind of, fairly abusive, and really rough on Johnny. Johnny Scoggins played the drums like nobody's business. He was a drummer, and we'd hang out. But Randy had procured this magazine, and some of you guys might be old enough to remember these cartoons, but it was basically like a thick cartoon book magazine, and it was called The Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. And it was these hippie dudes that run around screwing girls and smoking dope and probably all the stuff a 13-year-old should not be reading, but Randy had procured a couple of these, and back then porn was harder to come across, and so this was the closest look we were getting at boobs at that time. And of course me and him and Johnny were in Johnny's room looking through these magazines, and Johnny's dad comes in and sees the magazine and yanks it out of our hand, sends me and Randy home, and of course whips Johnny and yells at Johnny all night. And Johnny's not allowed to hang out with us no more. Because at first Johnny wasn't allowed to hang out with Randy, and then me and Johnny would still hang out a little bit. And then at some point his dad didn't want me coming over anymore either. Randy was always kind of getting crapped on like that. Treated as less than. I didn't realize it then when we were kids, but I realize it now looking back. It's one of those things that, you know, when you look back through the kaleidoscope and the long view lens of your life, that you can see things differently. And I realized that he was treated less than. And I didn't understand it when we were that age. I wish I had. I might have been a better friend. I might not. I was a pretty selfish kid. But me and Randy, we would walk up and down the railroad tracks every day just talking. We were friends. Randy was really into him and his young, he had a younger brother, and they were really into WWF back then. I was not the biggest wrestling kid. Wrestling's something I got into later on, but they loved WWF, watched all that sort of stuff. And my first real memories of watching wrestling was watching wrestling with Randy. In fact, we were watching wrestling at their house one time, and this is going to date how old I am, as if I've not already talked about that for 36 minutes. But we were watching wrestling, and it was Jake the Snake versus a fella they called the Earthquake. He was a large, large human being. And the Earthquake beats Jake the Snake in this rowdy match. And at the time, at that age, I did not understand how much of wrestling was scripted and how much of it was performance and how much... I mean, obviously, even though now I know it requires a great bit of athleticism to do what these guys do, but I didn't realize how much of it was performative back then. And Jake the Snake, if you remember, of course, had this big old snake. He'd get in a bag, and then after he wrestled somebody, he'd wrap a snake around him, let the snake tongue kiss him in the ear or something. I don't remember all of it, but at some point, Earthquake's winning this match. He takes Jake the Snake in the bag, you don't see it, and sets it up in the ring, and then goes back and forth across the ring three times and does his Earthquake butt slammer move onto the snake, effectively, in our minds, killing the snake. He does it several times while Jake the Snake mourns from the sidelines because he can't get there to help his snake buddy. And I didn't even like snakes. I'm not a snake guy. I'm not somebody to ever have a snake for a pet. They unnerve me a little bit. But I cried about that damn snake. I don't know, the cruelty of it. It just seemed like cruelty. And I'm soft-hearted about animals. And I cried about that snake. And I remember... I got my stuff and I went home because I didn't want to hang out anymore. I won't watch any more wrestling. And my dad convinced me it was all fake when he found out I was upset about it. But that stuck with me for a long time, you know, like it's certain things like that stick with you. Randy's a lot tougher than me and Johnny was. Randy had two older sisters, used to beat the shit out of him for sport. His one of his sisters, the one closest in age to us, she's a few years older than us. Her name was Teresa. And boy, when I was 13, 14 years old, I just thought Teresa was the prettiest thing that ever walked around. She was kind of cool and punk rock, and she wore combat boots and cool clothes, and she was just cooler than everybody else I knew. And I kind of had like a little teenage crush on her. I thought she was some kind of something. I remember she had them combat boots, and Randy borrowed them without telling her. And he came over and spent the night at my house. Well, then we had to walk back. So his neighborhood was like, we moved. At one point, we lived in the same neighborhood, like a street apart from each other. But then we moved to another neighborhood called Forest View, and it was about 2 or 3 miles away. And so me and Randy got up the next day and walked back to his house. And it was mostly just fields. You had to walk through a bunch of fields and a railroad track. And then you're back in Mission Bend once you got over A-Leaf Clothing. Back then, A-Leaf was very sparse. You know, there was just big empty fields everywhere. There wasn't as many sugarcane fields left. Like most of that had been cut down and was gone. But there was still just empty swaths of pasture everywhere and plenty of woods and stuff to go run around in, and it's all subdivisions and cookie cutter tract homes now. Well, we walked back to his house. Houston, so it's hot. And he walked in the house with those combat boots on, and Teresa realized he had her boots, and she came unhinged on his ass. Maybe take your boots off right there. And then she found out he wasn't wearing socks, and so he'd been sweating in her boots, and she was so pissed. And she was just railing him and slapping him, and he's like, well, Jerry ate my socks, you know, just being funny, just being Randy. But I was mortified, because now the hot, cool punk rock girl thought I ate a pair of socks, and then she yelled at me a little bit, went off to her room and slammed the door. I was so mad at Randy. Like, I don't know why I thought that was what threw me off. It's the first time I ever watched Saturday Night Live was at Randy's house. I didn't stay up that late. My parents didn't stay up late, you know. My parents weren't big TV people back then. We were kind of fresh out of the Pentecostal church, and they still, you know, here or there on too much TV late at night and anything risque. I remember the first time they had VH1, and the first time my dad saw the, my dad liked Madonna. He thought Madonna was something else. But then when he saw the Like a Prayer video for Madonna with the black Jesus in it and all the suggestive, Dad was ready to get VH1 taken off the air. He was, boy, we ain't gonna have that filth in my house. I'll be damned. Well, that old video don't even scratch the surface no more. But I watched Saturday Night Live the first time at Randy's house. We were spending the night, and his parents made us. His parents, I think they were from New York or somewhere up on the East Coast, but they made garlic cheese homemade pizza. And to this day, some of the best pizza I ever had in my life was at Randy Lee's house when I was a teenager. We would go to the lake a lot in the summer. We would go up to Lake Tyler, where Granny and Papa's barge was. And a couple times that the year I turned 13 or 14, it would have been 13. Year I turned 13, Randy went with us a couple times. Or one time, went up there and hung out for like a week or two at the lake. We had the best time swimming, cutting up. Then something happened right after. His parents split up right after that. And I don't know all the details. It ain't none of my business, no how. But it wasn't good. Whatever it was, it was a pretty rough event. I don't think divorce is ever good. But it's a particularly bad one. And I think Randy and his little brother felt the brunt of it. Randy got kind of mean. And I think when you get bullied enough, eventually you become the bully. It happened to me. It's happened to other people I knew who were bullied. And Randy became the bully for a little while. And he might not see it that way, and I might be wrong, but that was my perspective at the time. He got mean and a little unpredictable, and he started fighting more. We didn't hang out as much. And I was real hung up on Melissa. My dad took me and Melissa on a date to a haunted house. I've told y'all the story. I got scared and accidentally pushed Melissa into a wall trying to get away from a guy with a fake chainsaw and banged her face, and Melissa had a bruise on her face. And she was also one for the dramatic herself, so I don't know what stories she told people at school. Of course, I told everybody what had happened. You know, obviously, I did not hit a girl. That's not what happened. But I don't know. Me and Randy weren't that close at the time. And to this day, I don't 100% know. And I don't care enough to ask what what was behind what he did, but he walked up behind me in the lunchroom, and I like turned, when I turned to the right, he punched me in the side of the face, one of them big old fists, and knocked me down. And I bawled like a little baby. And I said, when you think about regrets in your life, like that's one that I was like a little, I cried, bawled, and the teachers ran over to me. And of course, another little girl I liked made fun of me about it later. Did a mockery of it, and it's like one of those things, one of those turning points in your life where I wished I just jumped up and started fighting back. He would have whooped my ass, but I wished I just jumped up and started fighting back, because then I'd feel better about that situation. But that's not what happened. I cried like a little baby, and me and him stopped hanging out. You know, it's kids, friendships with kids, that's how it goes. And I would hear stories about him because we were still, you know, I had kind of found my little bunch of outcasts, and he had kind of found his little bunch of outcasts, and we're still in this little community. As we grew up, I would hear stories about him, you know, beating somebody up and getting in trouble at school. You know, he started kind of going the dark route, you know, wearing the black clothes and shaved his head. And our neighborhood was 3 miles from here. I remember this. I was like probably 16 or 17 a few years later. And I had this friend down the street named Justin Webb. And Justin or his brother, one, had been picking on Randy's little brother, Chris. Chris is a giant now, but Chris was, he was kind of a tiny little old thing back then. And one of them had been picking on Chris at school or something. And Randy got his little brother and walked 3 miles to that neighborhood to knock on Justin's door. And when Justin opened the door, just knock him on his ass. Just punch him, knock him right on the ground, you know. Split his lip. I would hear these kind of stories, you know, and just not really think to you. You know, when you're a kid, you're not that introspective. Of course, years go by and we all live our own lives. And I would see him here or there. He would be hanging out with these dudes, and I'd be hanging out with these dudes. We'd run across each other. There's different places where everybody in A-Leaf sort of partied and hung out. And I would see him with his group. He'd see me with his group. Been working on this particular story. It goes in the book. But I had that little high school girlfriend, Amy. And we split up in high school. She broke up with me in high school and blamed it on me giving this other girl a ride home. That was not, it was not like anything like that. I just, this girl got shit on all the time. She needed a ride. I gave her a ride to her house. But I had found out there was this other dude that we went to school with named Trey. And Trey looked like a 30-year-old when we were in high school. And Trey had a bad crush on Amy. And Trey was kind of a loser. He always was kind of a loser. And he did manipulative, shifty things. And he had a crush on Amy. Now, I later found out that he was the one that went and told Amy he saw me. And he, of course, made it much more salacious, trying to break me and Amy. Yep, he did a good job because it worked. Years later, after I've been working in Mexico and stuff, me and Amy reconnect, and we date for a little while. Of course, she's looking for somebody to be a grown-up. I had no interest in that at that period of time. And I did something really awful, and I just ghosted that girl. And just stopped talking to her and just went on with my life. Rather than have an honest adult conversation with her about why we weren't going to work out like any rational human being would. He's young and dumb. And a couple of years after that, me and Joey happened to just be out one night drinking, doing our thing. Me in my early 20s at this point. And we go to the IHOP after a night of debauchery. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. We go in the IHOP, drunkenly eat our breakfast. And we were walking towards the cashier to go pay for our meal and leave. And I remember off to the left here, there's like one of those big round tables with the round booth around it. And there was Randy, shaved head, you know, tattoos, looking like he still beat anybody in the room. And at that table, as part of his group of outcasts, of course, also was Trey and some other dudes that I had known for many years growing up in A-Leaf. And there I was, my cowboy boot. They were looking kind of death metal and punk rock, and I had kind of fallen into the group of fellows who wore the cowboy boots and the belt buckles and the cowboy hat. And we're walking by, and it was like seeing somebody across a chasm. I looked at Randy, and Randy looked at me, and he kind of nodded. And I remember thinking in my head, like, why aren't we friends anymore? What happened? Why aren't we friends anymore? And I just kind of nodded back at him. And then I walked up to pay for my food. Of course, right when I get up to register to pay for my food, another ghost from the past, Amy, comes walking up with her mother and her sister. And she hollers at me, I thought you were dead, because I ghosted her. And before I could say another word, she just hauled off and slapped the piss out of me. I mean, just slapped me open-handed across the face. So hard that I dropped my change and money on the ground. And her and her mom and her sister just stormed by me. And I heard Randy and all them at that table just fall out laughing. And I bent down to pick up my change. And I was standing up, and I looked at Joey, and Joey just kind of gave me one of these, like, eh, you had it coming. You know what I mean? Because I did. I had it coming. I got off light, really. She was merciful. If that's all I got out of my behavior for that, I got off light. She was merciful to me for the anguish I put that girl through for no reason other than being stupid and cruel. But it was one of those turning points for me. That whole night was kind of a weird night, but it was like one of those turning points because that was one of those times where I felt like Uncle Bobby and not in a good way. I had seen literally almost that same interaction happen to him. And I remember thinking, I don't like the way this feels. I don't want people to feel about me that way. And I don't see Randy again for many years after that. Sometime after Hurricane Ike, 2008, after me and Rachel are married, I went to work. Me and Steve were working together, my buddy I've been telling you stuff about. Steve also grew up in A-Leaf. Me and Steve start working together, doing construction. One day we go over to Home Depot to pick up a big order construction materials, and this giant of a man comes walking up, and I realize that it's Randy Woods. And at the time he was running the pro desk at Home Depot. He was in charge of all the builders, big orders and all that stuff. He was the pro guy, and he knew Steve. And Steve's like, do you remember Randy from school? I was like, yeah, I remember Randy. Like, I know Randy. Like, yeah, bro, I know Randy. And we talked to him a little bit in the Home Depot. And he tells me at that time, this is 20-something years, 2008, however long ago that is. He tells me at that time, yeah, I'm getting ready. I'm not going to be here much longer because I'm opening my own tattoo shop. And he had already been doing tattoo work for many, many years and kind of developed his style at that point and had interned under another artist and I believe. I may have that screwed up. I don't want to say for sure that's how it went down. But he had taught himself, and he was getting ready to open his own shop. I guess he'd been saving up and preparing for that. And of course, Steve got excited because he's got a friend that does tattoo work, and he thinks he can get some cheap. By God, he's going to do it, you know. And Steve was going through his divorce, and he was going wild. And so Steve started going to his tattoo shop to get artwork done. And I had wanted to get this piece made for me and Rachel. It's me and Rachel's initials, and I had it put on the inside of my forearm. And so I went over, me and Rachel and Steve, I went over to Randy's shop, his first shop location one night, and he did that tattoo work for me. We reconnected a little bit, and it was good. But then me and Steve were going through our stuff, and we were, you know, our relationship was coming to a head. Somewhere in that time period, so Steve had a younger sister named La, Sheila. And La and my sister had been friends and were really close for a long time. And La had a son from a guy who wasn't really a very good dude, or at least I didn't think he was. He wasn't much in the way of fatherhood and that sort of thing. Bit of a screw up. And La had been raising her son on her own with the help of her family. And her and Randy met, and I don't know their exact love story because it happened while I was away, but they fell in love, and they got married. But that also got Steve deeper into Randy. And, of course, back then, I don't know who Steve is now. Maybe a wonderful human being, business person now. But back then, the entanglements with Steve usually went bad for whoever was entangled with Steve financially. And I think him and Randy's situation came to a head. I mean, I know it came to a head in that. But I kept up with Randy. I loved his artwork, and I loved seeing this dude, like, turn. Somebody had been in trouble a lot and all this kind of stuff, and I had this view of, I had seen, like, a remarkable, that first time I went and got that tattoo with him, we had such a great conversation, and I would follow him on Instagram and follow him on social media, and I watched him evolve, you know, like turn into this. He was inspiring. He had lost a bunch of weight. He was losing weight, and he was working out and getting his fitness, and he inspired me to start working out and start working. Randy's the reason I grew my beard. Randy had a big old long beard back then. I thought it looked cool, and I was like, man, I want a beard. And that's why I started growing my beard, was because of Randy. I thought it was cool. And then he cut his all off, but I like mine still, so I keep it. And we would talk a little bit, you know, through social media, stuff like that. And of course, a few years after, you know, you have kids and life just keeps rolling along. And I would keep up with Randy and La, and I was so happy. And Randy really, like, took on, I hate to use the word stepfather because he's more like a father to that kid, but her little son, Randy, took to that kid. And you just saw that kid blossom into a good young man underneath Randy's tutelage. And you also saw that kid wasn't going the direction of maybe me and Randy and Steve had gone as young people, because he had some good guidance, somebody that was taking the time. Randy became a Mason in that time period, and I really watched him flourish after becoming a Mason. Masonry is not for me. It's not something I have any interest in pursuing. And they probably wouldn't want me anyways, honestly. But I just watched him continue to evolve. It was really cool. And a few years after my mom had passed, I went to Randy with this tattoo idea. And he, of course, wanted to do it. He knew my mom. And he did this beautiful artwork for me. And we had a great reconnection that we spent a lot of time you know, it takes a long time to do a piece like that. And we really got to spend some time talking and interacting with one another. And I started following him more closely. And then during the Whiskey Brothers podcast, I had him on as a guest to talk about his shop. And this dude, I just watched him during Harvey, his shop on Highway 6 flooded, 5 foot of water inside it. The whole time Randy's doing him and La would get in clown makeup and go do clown work for the Shriners at the Shriners Hospital for the kids. And they would go do the Shriners circuit. He's just doing stuff for his community, doing toys for tots. We had another friend named Peter that this dude went through all kind of crap. And I just found out like the enormity of everything Randy did for this guy while this guy was in prison. This guy was in prison. His son dies. Then he gets deported to Poland. And they don't accept his education in Poland. And Randy spends just hours getting this guy's transcripts and getting the international notary to like help this dude out. It just goes and tells him in prison that his son has died. He just continues to be this person in the community, this better person than I ever dreamed of being, honestly, in his works and his attitude. And he like that last time when I saw him, when he did my hand tattoo, he was so zen. He was such a remarkably different guy than the guy I knew as a teenager. He just seemed so deliberate and in control of his life. He had a child that was taken from him by the mother, and I don't know all the details of it, but I do know that Randy moved heaven and earth to try to get that baby back and get to a point where he was able to have a relationship with his child. And that says something about a man's character. His father's sick. He takes care of his father. It says something about a man's character. He looked after his little brother always. That says something. It was a beautiful thing to watch from a distance and to know this person. It made me proud to know this person. And he said something. We were talking about masonry in his shop Friday, and he said something that struck me. He told me that he said, you know, one of the things he really enjoys about masonry was there's no other place where he would have friends that are men that are his age and older and much older, you know, some of them 80, 90. And he said, they're far more successful than I ever dreamed of being. And I don't know what kind of success those guys have or what benchmark they're using to measure success or even what benchmark he does. But when he said that, I kept thinking, no, you're the successful one. You gave this kid, his stepson has had a different life because of him. And anybody denies that's a fool and a liar. Gave this young man guidance, gave him a path. That young man, I think, is about to go in the Air Force. Like, I don't think that's the path that young man would have had under the guidance of his uncles. You know? Let's wrap it up right there. Let's do some testimonies. All right. I got these all ready. We're going to do something special in the testimonials today because I realized something that I'm going to do this one first. For those of y'all listening, you're not going to get much out of this, but this is for the people who like to participate. So when my episodes air on YouTube on Sundays at 5:30 p.m. Central Time, I like that when you go to YouTube and you go to look at the video and underneath the video is the comments, you can swipe that to the left. You can just click right there and swipe left and it'll put you in a live chat. And I like to hang out in the live chat on Sundays at 5:30 while the episode's airing just to bullshit with folks and have some fellowship with you guys that want to show up. So I know the listening guys can't do that, but you fellas watching, you know, some of y'all in the chat right now, there's a guy that comments on my video every Sunday without fail, and I can tell he watches it right when he comes on because he's always the first comment. There's a fellow named Mike Fleisner. I've read some of his comments before, and it dawned on me reading some of his comments on the last couple episodes that I think Mike's trying to get into the live chat and it's not working for him. So I'm going to show a little video right here over my shoulder that shows, and Mike, I hope you're watching, how to get in the live chat, because it's not very clear. It took me a little while to figure it out, and it's not very clear. But this, if you watch this video, it shows you how to get into the live chat in case you ever want to show up and hang out with us in the live chat. And because Mike just leaves me so many comments, and I was like, man, you would have such a good time in the live chat with us, Mike, and I would love to chit-chat with you. You know, because he always comments on everything. And yeah, I can tell from his comments that he's commenting along with the video as he's watching it. And you just ought to be in the live chat with us, brother. And this is for anybody that doesn't know how to get in the live chat. So I'll show this quick little video, and I'm just going to guess that it takes about 10 to 15 seconds. And I'll probably just keep talking while that's happening. But if you need to know how to get in the live chat, that little video shows how to do it. And I just want to do that because Mike comments every week, and I'm like, brother, you ought to be in the live chat with us. And I think you're trying to get there, but YouTube's not very clear about how to do it. So if you get in the live chat, we're all chatting in real time, and it's always a good time. Sometimes some weeks it's quiet. I've learned. Funny enough that the better the podcast is, the quieter the chat is because y'all are busy watching. And then if the podcast is a little boring, it gets real chatty. They ain't all winners. I know they ain't. I write this thing every week in between life and creating all my other content. And I know I've been dragging while I've been working on this book. So I get it. My feelings ain't hurt. Nobody has to like every episode. Some of y'all, I lost some fans during that second season where I was doing all the voices and the characters, and it was just too much for everybody. All right, there'd be enough time to watch that video, figure out how to get in here. Let's go. At the Croncraft Show 4227. These are testimonials. These are comments from last week's episode. Testimonial, if you will. Croncraft Show. I was talking about language last week. Talking about the Scots, Irish, and the Welsh, or your Celtic cousins, you have some of the same speech patterns as ourselves. You say batteries instead of batteries for the word batteries. I can't wait to read your book, and with your blessing, I'll read it aloud in my Dublin accent. I'm not a voice actor. I just think it'd be a fun project. I would love to hear my words read in a Dublin accent. I wish I could do accents so bad. I think we do have some of the same speech patterns. The Appalachian speech patterns, I'm not, you know, I'm never trying to claim that I'm Appalachian, but my family, all Appalachian, really on both sides. Come from that place. And so I was raised in Texas, you know, we got a lot of rednecks, and I was raised by hillbillies, people that come from the hills and that have those speech patterns. And I think they do closely resemble. I love reading stuff from Scotland and Ireland, and I can tell the writing similarity and the similarity in the way you put words together to make a sentence. So I see that too. I did not know y'all said the word battery though, which is delightful to me. Battery is because of my Papa Longmire, who is very much a hill man from Tennessee. And he's the reason I say battery, because it was just a battery, you know. Let's see, who else we got this week? At Jake of all trades, our old buddy Jake. I can't stand when some mouth breather decides to pace the car next to him and block the effing highway up. I don't get mad about much, but I think it's because I get my anger out in the highway. Yeah, and you drive a bunch. If you're the guy, nope, I'm confusing you with another guy. Maybe not. I don't know. I know two Jakes from that area up in the Midwest, and I get y'all confused sometimes. But I know one of you is a mobile mechanic, drives all over the place. So you probably spent a lot of time on the highway. That drives me batty too. Use the left lane like it's supposed to be used, or don't just stay out of it, man. Why in the hell would you drive the exact same speed as the car next to you? That don't make no damn sense, unless you're just directly trying to be an antagonistic monster. Why would you do that? If you're not passing somebody, get the hell out of the left lane. Or if you're in Ireland, I guess get the hell out of the right lane. Is y'all's left lane still the pass lane, or is your right lane the pass lane? It seems like it'd probably be the right lane. Yeah, that drives me batty. It drives me nuts. Really, what really drives me off the deep end is the truck drivers now. And I grew up around truck drivers, and no disrespect to the job whatsoever. I'm aware of the value of the service that truck drivers provide to our country and our communities, and giving us the goods and making sure we get the things we need when we need them. But so many of the trucks are governed now. And so you got this guy who's going 1 mile an hour faster than this guy, and now he's going to pull out and try to pass him. And now you're stuck behind the longest, most boring drag race in history for 7 miles while this truck going 1 mile an hour tries to get over in front of this other guy. Like, first of all, the dude going slower, you see him getting around to pass him, tap your brake. You know he's going fast. You let him get up in front of you and clear, keep the highway clear. No reason to dog everybody up over that. Oh, so you guy that's going 1 mile an hour faster, is it that big a deal? Clock it back a mile. I don't know how your money works. Ain't my business, but it's infuriating. I was coming out of Nashville on my way up to Louisville one time, and I was coming out of Nashville about 6 o'clock in the morning. I got stuck behind one of these that I shit you not went on for 12 miles. Just stuck behind these two, most of them barely doing over 65. Good Lord. Took me 6 hours to get to Louisville that day. I was so hot the time I got there. I'm with you, Jake. I know I preach a message of kindness, but whoo, this is not the message I preach when I'm behind the wheel. Everybody but me is a dirty, rotten, low-down son of a bitch when I'm behind the wheel. I cuss everybody on that highway. Oh, that is some terrible coffee. My God, I kept thinking it was going to get better, like maybe it's an acquired taste. And I don't know what the hell you got to do to acquire that taste, but I ain't got the stones for it today. All right, let's wrap this thing up. Yeah, I told you that about Randy saying that about the success. It struck me, and I had to sit down and write about it. Not only that, but the reconnection. There's a deep kind of value in having folks who remind you where you come from. Not the ones who try to haul you back into the mess. We've talked about that. God knows I got blood relatives who could drag you into 1998 faster than a relapse. But the ones who survived the same storms you did, and even worse storms, and came out on the other side without turning into a cautionary tale on a billboard. Folks who can look at your past with that quiet, knowing grin that says, yep, we should both be dead, and yet here we are. Miracles happen. I've seen all kinds of definitions of success floating around out there. I think most of us, most people measure it with money. Hell, I've done it too.
I thought if I ever hit financial success, I'd turn into the kind of man who sleeps through the night and doesn't panic when the phone rings from an unknown number. It turns out money doesn't fix your demons. It just buys them nicer shoes. And depending on the demon, they might buy a gun too. These days, I find myself pointing my ship towards the kind of success Randy's carved out. Randy's not rich. He's not flashy, but he's deliberate, solid. The kind of man who knows exactly who he is and doesn't apologize for it. He took a stepson, a young man who could have gone sideways in a dozen different ways. Instead of preaching or posturing, he just showed up steady, reliable, stubborn in all the most holy of ways. That boy didn't need a superhero. He needed a man he could anchor to, and Randy was that anchor. He helps his community. He minds his business. He absolutely does not go looking for a fight, but if a fight shows up on his doorstep and threatens the folks he loves, he will turn into a cautionary headline real quick. He's respected by his peers, appreciated by his neighbors, and watched very closely by anyone who wants to get out of line that values their dental configuration. You can't buy that kind of success. You got to earn it the long way, the bloody, uncompromising, grown man way. And if that isn't success, I don't know what the hell is. The truth is, when you start measuring success by character instead of cash, the list of successful people in your life gets real damn short. Most folks are one bad week away from lighting their life on fire. Some don't even wait for the bad week. They just keep matches in the drunk drawer just in case. Don't get me wrong. I'd still like to try financial success. I've heard that money can't buy happiness, and maybe that's true, but I also know poverty can't buy shit, so I'm willing to run the experiment. Worst case scenario, I buy a boat and ruin my life in a fun new zip code. But the real point is you got to watch how you measure success. If you use the wrong parameters, you'll swear your life is off course when really you're doing just fine. Some of y'all think you're failures because you ain't rich. But I know plenty of rich people who ain't successful. Not if you judge by who they are when the lights go out. A lot of them couldn't guide a houseplant, much less a child. Success ain't shiny. It ain't loud. Hell, half the time, I think success just looks like my buddy Randy. Steady as an oak, dangerous when provoked, gentle where it counts, and unwilling to let the world chew up someone who's counting on them. The kind of man who'd give you the shirt off his back while muttering, "Damn it, don't bleed on that, I've only got three." That's success. That's the mark worth chasing. If I can manage even half of that before my time's up, you know, before that time they lay me out nice and tidy and pretend I look peaceful and say a bunch of nice things about me, if I can achieve half what he's done, I'll call it a win. I hope you're measuring success in the right ways. I hope you're not comparing your life to others based on financials, and more so based on respect and how you treat people. You know, it's that Sturgill Simpson song where he says, "Everybody shake hands with everybody you meet and cheat and greet along the way. We all got some flaws. We all made some mistakes. But by God, it's what you continue to do that matters." And I hope that's how you're measuring your success every week. I hope that's what you're looking for in life. I'm rooting for you. Always. Always will be. I'm JW, and I love you. Boogity, boogity, boogity.
Oh, Lordy, I got a lot to do today. I keep forgetting how nasty that coffee is. My God. Y'all be safe. I'll see you next week.